Hey everyone, and welcome to Be the Leader You Deserve podcast, where my mission is to inspire you to ask yourself, are you the leader you deserve? Hi, I'm Jill Handley, and I'm so excited to be here with you today. This is season 7, episode 14, Inclusionary Leadership, How to Lead as Your Most Authentic Self. This is an episode you will not want to miss as I get to chat with one of my very favorite leaders and friends, Ed Paris. So today I'm so excited to be joined by Ed Paris, principal of Avery Elementary School, located in Dedham, Massachusetts. Now, in addition to supporting his own school, Ed supports principals across the country, presenting at the local, state, and national level. And I had the opportunity to meet Ed this summer at NAESP conference, and oh my goodness, we immediately connected, so I could not wait for this episode. So welcome, Ed.
Oh, thank you so much. And I'm so excited that we're reconnecting after, I mean, like you just said, I just feel like you and I just made such a connection so quickly down there at NAESP. It's one of the things I love about it.
Yeah, same. It's like, you know, you can follow people on Twitter or, you know, connect on other social media platforms. And then sometimes you've not even connected yet. And so you're right. That's one of the great things about conferences, just in general, is being able to, you know, reconnect with old connections and then make new connections. So I'm so glad that you're with us today.
Thank you so much.
So as we get started, I know that you've just recently left your previous school and taken on the role of principal at a new school. So why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and a little bit about the school that you're leading?
Yeah, sure. So I've been in education now. I'm going into my 13th year in Dedham, and I'm going into my 16th year in education. I started out in Dedham as a fourth grade teacher. And then, you know, I knew eventually I was going to want to take on some sort of leadership role. I didn't know what it was. So I went back and I got my CAGs in educational leadership. And it was actually, I was finishing up the degree, a job opened up in Dedham at a school I had not been principal of. And I applied honestly just to see what the process was like. I was 30 years old. So I thought, all right, well, there's certainly no way I'm going to get this job. So I'll just see what the process is like. And it was a courtesy interview. I have no doubt in my mind. I know it was a courtesy interview. But then I made it to the next round and then the next round. And next thing you know, Jill, they offered me the job. So
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, 30 years old sitting in this chair thinking, what do I do? I have no idea what I'm doing here. So I was there for 7 years. I said, even when I started at the school, I was very open and honest with the community. And I said, you know, I will not retire from this position. It just wouldn't have been genuine. So I knew I wanted to see at least 3 cohorts go completely through the school. So that would have been 7 years. So I just wrapped up my 7 year and I was kind of putting some feelers out. And luckily enough, a principal at another elementary school, one that I had actually taught at for 3 years, was retiring. So I put in my request to transfer. And luckily enough, I got the transfer. So July 1st, I started. So I'm at the Avery Elementary School. It's slightly bigger. I'm going from a school of, wait till you hear this, Jill. I was the principal of a school of 172 students at Riverdale.
Stop it.
I know. Are you ready to kill me? Honestly, right? And then now I'm the principal of 310 students, which to me is like, oh my goodness, that's so much bigger. But how many kids are at your school, Jen?
We're about 580 right now. So yeah, either one of those sounds like a dream to me. I'm like, what do you even do with 176 kiddos?
Right. And that's one of the things I start my presentations off by saying to people is like, you know, the one thing I will say is just remember, sometimes depending on the students you're dealing with, the families you're dealing with, the staff you're dealing with, sometimes 172 students, some days feels like 500 and something students.
Yeah, for sure. And probably, you know, there are other days that, you know, it feels like you're 300 and something. I bet you're, how are you feeling about that? Like, just is there a little bit of anxiety almost to have doubled the amount of students that they're going to have, the amount of teachers you're going to have, the amount of families you're going to have?
Everything grows, right? I mean, I pride myself on my relationship building. I, again, you know,
Jill, I think you and I are very, very similar. And I think that's why you and I connected so quickly, because I think relationships are important to you as well.
Yes.
Yeah. So I think that's honestly, that is my biggest anxiety, I guess, is I always want to be the best at things. And one thing that I really want to be the best at is I will know every student's name. Now, usually for the past 7 years, I've only had to learn the first graders' names coming in because I knew everyone else. Now I have to learn everyone's name, and I really pride myself, and I get to know my families because I do think that's really important. So that's the anxieties, right? These folks don't know me. They know me a little bit, and I send things out so that way they can kind of get to know who I am, but they don't know me. And my last families, they grew with me. They kind of taught me how to be a principal. I was this 30-year-old kid that they really trusted. So it's going to be gaining that, you know, starting at the beginning, gaining the trust. I'm lucky that I have, you know, I think a little bit of a reputation in the district. So that's good. But yeah, there's some anxiety there.
So let's talk a little bit about that, Ed. So, you know, what advice do you have? So clearly you're not a brand new principal, but starting a brand new school for you, what are your first steps? I know that, like you mentioned, relationships and community partnerships are, I know, high on your priority list. And so we've had several guests that have talked about what's the first thing you do with your staff, but I'm going to take it a little bit different direction with my question for you. Because you've been mentioning, you know, reaching out to your families. So what are your first steps when you're the brand new principal? Because you're right. When you know, after you've been there for a while at your school, everyone knows you, right?
Right.
So how do you kind of get that momentum snowballing quickly at a brand new school with families and community members?
You know, the first thing in any leadership program worth its weight will tell you the first thing you do when you're a new principal is you listen and you observe, mm-hmm. right? You don't come in and say, all right, I'm going to make all these changes. So that's really what I've been doing this summer. I've been listening a lot. The first thing I did is I sent out an email to my staff and I sent out a Google form. And, you know, I think people are pretty familiar with a SWOT analysis, SWOT, strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. I used really that format I changed some of the meanings where like strengths, absolutely. What are the strengths of the school? And I asked teachers to let me know what it was. And instead of, I hate the word weaknesses, Jill. It's such a negative term, right? What are the areas for improvement? What areas for refinement? What can we build upon? So that was the next opportunities. That's what I explained to staff is what are our points of leverage? Are there community members I should be reaching out to? Are there things that are happening at the school already we need to make sure we keep? And then instead of threats, instead I actually changed that to just what are the low-hanging fruits? What are the things that I could change day one that won't have that unintended consequence, that everyone will be really happy that changed? That, you know, Ed, don't wait the first 90 to 180 school days. Change this day one because we're all yearning for it. So I sent that out and then I just invited people I sent out a Google sheet with times that I was available to come in and meet. And I said, if these times don't work, we'll make another time. And I just invited staff in. I just wanted to hear and talk. And that's been most of my summer is really just listening and letting people have the principal's ear. Cause you know, Jill, we get so busy. Sometimes we're kind of hard to nail down. So they had me and I did kind of a similar thing with my families. I reached out to the PTO and I've been talking to them and I plan on doing the same thing with students. I'm going to talk to students in every grade level once they're in the building and I'm going to pull them and I'm going to talk to them about what are his strengths, but also what are things that you feel like need to be changed? What's going to make your experience better? Because that's the first year. You have to come in, learn what people like happening, but also talk to people about what they would really love to change and feel that they had a hand in making of the school.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting when you look to maybe triangulate your responses to see, what similarities exist between the three role groups and then what differences exist between the three role groups. I think that'll be an interesting thing for you to see. And Ed, you talked about something that is so important and I think a mistake that so many brand new principals make is that they think you have to come in with an agenda Mm-hmm. Or oftentimes, I think new leaders that I mentor sometimes, you know, think that, oh, I've got to have it just perfect. No. To your point, just go in and observe, because to your point, we're just building relationships and observing and taking it all in that first year. I tell everybody, in my opinion, your first year in any job, if you survive, you're successful.
Like, yes, that's
a successful year. And then if you can take in a few things and start to build that trust with your stakeholders, then it's been an extra successful year. So yeah. Well, Ed, I know, you know, I follow you on Twitter and I've seen some of your YouTube stuff. And so it's so exciting. Your recent Lizzo, I love that so much. So you have so much to be proud of. You have so much great energy and have such great culture. But I don't want to bait you with what I think you're going to answer with this question. But when you think about all the experiences that you've had as a school leader, what would you say the one thing that you're most proud of is?
You know, and that's the thing. I probably used to say culture, right? And I do those relationships, sure. But the one thing I would say I'm proudest of, and it's not just me, but it's the teams that I work with and the staffs that I've worked with, is really the work my staff and I have done around inclusionary practices.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's why, Jill, the session that you did at NAESP around, you know, English language learners and, mm-hmm. You know, and making sure that it was called changing it from a deficit to an asset. And it's so true, right? It's including everyone and making sure that everyone feels included. That is definitely what I'm most proud of. We, you know, in Dedham, we have so many programs which support students, but one thing I felt that was kind of lacking was it was kind of trying to fit everyone into a box. Mm-hmm. And what that can do is that can end up making people feel kind of excluded.
Yes.
You know, maybe you didn't get to go to your neighborhood school. And the staff that I've worked with for the past 7 years and the staff that I'm getting ready to work with now too, we want folks to drink the cream, not the skim milk. We believe that everyone deserves to be included. So I'm most proud of my work. That's my long-winded version of saying, I'm most proud of the work I've done with my folks around inclusionary practices.
And, you know, I think that it feels like it's becoming more and more prevalent, but I think that, you know, when I say prevalent in the sense of in the news, if you will, but to me, that's like, gosh, that's so sad that we're just now recognizing how important it is to make everyone, adults and students, feel like they belong. Isn't that a shame that we're just now focusing on that after all these years?
And I wonder what, and you know, I think that's, I will say though, that's a nice reflective practice of any good teacher, right? To think about, but I do think about when I look back on my past 13 years, oh gosh, like what did my past practices, maybe how did those affect some of my former students? Was I not as inclusive as I should have been? But yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not going to get up on a soapbox too much here, Jill, but far be it from anyone to say that we as the educators in the building should not be making sure that every kid that walks through that door, but also their family, feels like they belong there. That's our job as educators. That's step one.
Yes. And, you know, and when I say we, I mean the collective big we,
yes.
You know, and our staff have, you know, and you and I could probably get up on a tangent with this, but I know, I talk with my staff and I say, gosh, because this is year 26 for me. And I say, the way things have evolved is in the sense of when I graduated with my teaching degree all those years ago, you know, when you said something like, oh, I don't see color, you know, I treat all my children the same. That was kind of, I don't mean like just the thing to say, but that kind of was what you were supposed to be,
yes.
Right?
Yep.
And now that color blindness, that's wrong, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So you better see color, you better see the differences, you know, that exist, because otherwise, to your point, we're trying to put everybody in a box. So I just, you know, when my staff and I reflect upon that and I tell them and I say, you know, we're all just, I will just say, what we grew up with and everything like that, but just how it's just evolved in such a short time. But I think it's very exciting times as we start to evolve more and just to be so inclusive with our environments, to your point, not just with our kids, but to our families as well. And I always say that I think like we're so close to unlocking the door that we do so many things and we have for years with kids, that now I think we're right there. The minute that we unlock it with the families and the communities, it's like it's sealing the deal for getting ready to just skyrocket, you know?
The power of it. Yeah. And I think, you know, Jill, you and your staff should be applauding yourselves with the work you've done down there. But also, right, like that's what we're supposed to be doing, is we're supposed to be growing not just as educators, but just as people, right? Yes. I mean, I think it's okay to admit, because that I was the same way, right? Like, I don't see color. No, I don't. Well, yeah, no, now I do, because I know I should be seeing their color. I should be seeing color. I should be recognizing their cultures. And it's okay to say what I thought then was wrong. Yes. But through learning and growth, now I know this. And I do sometimes wonder if people get stuck in thinking, well, if I give up what I have believed to be true, then it's making me look wrong and possibly ignorant or stupid. And that's not it at all. It's just showing that you grew and you learned. I think there's such power in that.
Oh, that is such a good statement. And I think you're right. I think there's something to be said about what is that, you know, people getting stuck in that. Well, if I admit this now, what does that say about me? Well, I mean, I think about any practice. Every year I'm trying to grow and reflect. And every year I think, oh, I could have been better for those kids, for those teachers the year before. Because let's face it, we learn and grow and get better every year. And that's the goal of it all.
Yep, I agree, Jill. I totally, and that's reflected in the work that you, I mean, I've been talking about your school a lot, Jill.
This teachers,
and that's the work you guys are doing down there. You're doing the good work.
You are so sweet. Thank you for that. So speaking of good work and successes and what I'm going to call failures, that was definitely one of them for me. So many of the things that we do as leaders started out not so successful. And so when you think about the experiences that you've had that might not have started out successful, but you failed forward and learned from that, what would you say are two or three of the things that you feel, Ed, are most impactful that you feel other leaders would benefit from hearing from you?
I think the first thing, especially as a new and young leader, especially, you know, I was leading a staff of folks that were just a year or two away from retirement. They've been doing this way longer than I have. And I think one thing that I didn't do was, you know, I would caution new leaders to make sure that they make sure to do this. I should have stuck to my instincts more. I think I have pretty good instincts. And I think that is why I was hired to do the job that I'm doing. And I would tell new leaders that you were hired for a reason. You know, we're not just picked off the street. So I would say, I wish I'd stuck to my instincts more. I think I was talked into some practices because, you know, some folks wanted me to. I think about, you know, exclusionary practices. The number of students that I've suspended has decreased immensely because I've become more secure in my beliefs around education and my beliefs around proper discipline. And that doesn't include exclusionary practices. So I think I failed that, but like you said, I failed forward, right? I think I've adjusted my practices. So I would say that's definitely one. And I think just always making sure that you're keeping kids first. Mm-hmm. I know Adam Welcome, and I listened to him speak one time, and I don't know if this is his quote or not, so I don't want to, you know, miscredit it, but he said it, and it really stuck with me. Schools were not built so adults could have jobs. You know, so we're here for kids. So I think just making sure I have the kids' best, you know, intentions at heart. So even, and that also means that when a parent calls and says, you know, Johnny's not in class with his best friend, instead of being nervous and saying, oh gosh, I don't want to make this parent upset by not switching the class, instead you flip it and say, well, actually it's in the student's best interest for them to stay in this class. And here's why. And so I think, you know, just making sure our kids' interests are coming first, lead with kids first.
And, you know, I love that I love that. No one has talked about that whole when you take the job, maybe because you're one of the youngest guests I've had. Perhaps that's it. like at a younger, you know, taking the job at a younger age. But I think that's a really valid point. And I think as we continue to move on, you know, with new leaders who are probably coming in at the leadership role earlier and earlier, that's a real thing, right? When a lot of your staff is either older than you are or more experienced, you know, the job, there's a confidence shift for any, whether regardless of what age you are, right? Or how much experience you have. But I think that that's a real thing for people who come in and start to second guess themselves because of the experience of the staff. And so I love that point that you made was, trust yourself, trust that they chose you for the reasons that you displayed in that interview. And when you start to question that, then you're kind of going against what they were looking for.
So absolutely. Right. They hired you because you were the person sitting in the seat for your experiences. Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely. That is such great wisdom. All right. So, you know, you talked a little bit about when you're going through leadership prep and you're like, I think I'll just try this, you know, just get some experience. And then lo and behold, you got the job. And so right out of leadership prep. So clearly leadership prep could not prepare us for everything this job entails. But when you think back to what you learned and then what you've had to learn on the job, what are one or two things that, man, if they had only taught this, I think I would have been better prepared.
You know, it's funny, Jill, when I saw, and I know that your listeners know this because I've listened to your podcast as well. I'm a listener, not just a participant. But, you know, when I saw this question, I was like, oh, my goodness. It's like she made this question for me because this is actually what I just presented at the state conference in Massachusetts for. And it's I'm proposing it to for the next NAESP for next summer. Down at National Harbor is that's the name of my presentation. What they didn't teach me, lessons learned on the job and why they're important to learn.
Because well then, oh my goodness. Well, let's get a sneak peek of that.
Right. and that's, so there's so many. My biggest one is definitely, I didn't realize, and they didn't teach me how much of myself I would need to give. And I say that deliberately in the tone I did. I mean like my actual self, not of myself, right? We all give ourselves every single day, but my actual self, I didn't know how much I would need to let my community and my teachers and my students know about me. You know, and I think that can be a little scary. I'm an extrovert, as I'm sure you can tell. So I don't mind, but I'm imagining there are great principals out there that are a bit more introverted, that's gotta be a tough lesson to learn. So, you know, I, especially as a white man, and I would say a white man of privilege, I had a pretty privileged upbringing. And, you know, my current school that I'm about to start at is 50% non-white. Okay. So, you know, those selected populations of non-white, economically disadvantaged, first language, not English, or English language learners, those are the families that I need to really work to make connections with, because when they look at me, I'm not them. So I need to really make sure that I'm giving my whole self to them so they get to know me and they can make those connections. So I think, you know, as also a very proud LGBTQIA+ principal, as a gay man, as a principal, I think it's important. And I'm not saying I go in and, you know, I'm not preaching the gay word all day, but I think, you know, for those young people who see a successful gay man leading their school, and when they do find out, if I happen to mention something, or last year I was asked to speak at the Pride flag raising event in Dedham. And I think, you know, when students see themselves in you and see, okay, I can be a successful man or a successful gay person, or when they see a person of color as a principal that, or a person of color as their teacher, that's why representation is so important. So I do. So again, I hope your listeners know this episode is going to be about 2 hours long with how much I talk, but it's buckle in, kids. But I think that's the thing. I didn't know how much of myself, my actual self, my actual being, I would need to give. And it's important. It's an important lesson to learn. And listeners out there, you need to know that. You need to let your families, your communities know exactly who you are and who they're dealing with. That vulnerability can get you a lot of pull. It's a good thing.
And you know, Ed, that you know, not clearly having the experience that you're speaking of, because you know, I'm the pretty traditional look for education, you know, middle class white woman. And at the same time, I have to admit that throughout my career, there are things that I'm like, ooh, do I share that? I mean, something is, I will never forget one time I thought I wanted to get my nose pierced. And I remember our secretary at the time was like, okay, Jill, you already have tattoos. I'm not sure if our community is ready to have a principal with their nose pierced as well. And he, you know, albeit that was probably 12 years ago, but at the same time, and I didn't, because I was like, oh yeah. She's probably right. But again, at that time we weren't doing all the work, unfortunately, that you were talking about, recognizing the importance of kids seeing themselves, and not just because of skin color, but because of so many things. Do you know? And so how do you, that's a courageous thing. And so how do you balance that, knowing that you're going to get some kickback from some of the community or some of the family? So how do you stay true to who you are, sharing your true self, and still staying tough with that? Because that's got to take some real courage there.
Yeah, I mean, I think before I answer that question, I'll tell you right now that next summer at National Harbor, I'm taking you to get your nose pierced. I can't wait. So let's set a date for that, Jill.
Well, you know, I have to say that I'd go for another tattoo first, because both of my daughters have had their noses pierced. I've watched it and I'm like, yep, no, I'm good. I'm good. No, we're good.
We'll get the NAESP logo tattooed somewhere, Jill. It's going to be great. Dr. L. Franks is going to love that.
Right.
I think it's especially now, right, where we do have, you know, in certain parts of this country where people are saying, you know, you should, you know, the people call it the Don't Say Gay Bill or things like that, right?
Right.
I think, you know, for me, again, it's kids' best interest first. I know that I always put the interest of kids first, and their education will always come first. So there's a time and a place. If they find out that I'm a gay principal while I'm speaking at a pride flag raising ceremony, I think that's the best place to say it. Or eventually, I'm not married, but eventually when I'm married and I talk about my husband, the power that's going to come behind that. It's those natural times. Just like, you know, we can't, you know, there are certain precedents under the United States Supreme Court that, you know, you can't push religion in schools. You can't do that. So I don't do that either, because that wouldn't be appropriate. So I think I just know in my heart of all hearts, down to my core, that everything I do is in the best interest of kids. When it comes to kids, I come second, and I always put kids first when I'm in my role. So as long as I know at my core I'm doing it, that folks can say what they want. There's always gonna be someone to talk about you, but as long as you know at your core, kids are coming first, that's how I do it. I think, so it's funny to hear you say courageous, and that warms my heart. So thank you for saying that. But I truly think it's just that I have the best interest of kids always at my heart.
Well, I think courageous in the sense that knowing all of the additional pressures or harsh words that could come your way as a result of it. But, you know, as you sit there and think, is that, you know, if you being so bold and courageous allows one student to feel like they can be seen or heard now, like that's all worth it, right?
And so exactly.
And so I think about that all the time. You know, we field phone calls quite often as we're trying to, you know, make our curriculum more inclusive. And so, you know, when I talk with families about, oh, you know, the teacher read this book about blah, 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 you know, two moms in, you know, classroom and blah, blah, and I'm not really teaching that to my child at home, you know, and those are real phone calls that we get, you know.
Yeah. And you might not be teaching it to your kid, but you know what? They're seeing it. The world is teaching it
to them.
Well,
and basically, no, and my response is always the same, is, well, you have to understand that the important thing for us is that all of our children see themselves reflected when they're here in our school. And so, you know, just like not all families are, you know, it's not like anybody, people wouldn't be complaining if I was reading a book about a divorced couple. because right? And that's kind of the same thing. And so it's exciting to be able to take your school to a place to where it becomes so much more inclusive. I'm circling back around because I feel like this is just a real theme of what we're talking about here, but it's just so exciting. You know, when kids feel like they belong because of something you've said or something you've done, sometimes not even intentionally. So kudos to you. I'm so proud of you. Continuing to put kids first, because I remember before I started being a principal, you know, we had guest speakers come in, and two of the best pieces of advice that I heard. The first one was, the best thing you can give your great teachers is to surround them by other great teachers. And then the other thing I heard was, as long as you always anchor your decisions in what's best for kids, you will always be able to sleep well at night. And I believe that.
That is so true. That is beautifully said. It is, right? You and I can sleep well tonight because we know.
Yes.
That, right, everything we do is with student safety and student learning at heart.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So clearly, you know, in all of your successes, and we've talked a little bit about some of the challenges, but Ed, when you think about the challenges that you faced as a leader, what would you consider to be your toughest challenge? And then how did you go about overcoming that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think, you know, and I'm sure a lot of people would reference COVID, and that was super hard. Don't get me wrong. It was really challenging. But actually, in October 2019, so just before COVID hit, Dedham Public Schools teachers went on strike. So yeah, that, and we thought that was the hottest thing we were going to have to deal with, and then COVID happened. But yeah, the teachers going on strike was really tough. And I'll tell you, it's not because I disagreed with them or agreed with them. It's the role that you need to play as a principal in a situation like that, is really, you walk in the middle. You have to be there for your teachers. And I'll give my superintendent credit, and he wouldn't mind me saying this, is he said to us principals, listen, you need to make sure you keep relationships strong with your teachers. Even though, you know, we might be disagreeing at the negotiation table. And this is when, like, this, because, you know, when teachers end up going on strike, there comes a point that the snowball just gets so big and starts rolling so fast down the hill that it's inevitable. You know it's going to happen. And it's kind of a scary time. But even during that, you know, my superintendent said, you're the ones that are going to be working with these hardworking teachers after the strike, day to day, face to face. So you make sure that you keep those relationships strong with those teachers, no matter what we're dealing with at the central office. So that was one piece. And it was really having to struggle with my thoughts around, okay, if they go on strike, my students are out of school for a day. Some of them aren't going to get lunch that day. They're not. That's a day off of learning. So I struggled with that a little bit, right? There were some points where I was like, no, teachers, don't do this to our kids. But it's also, I grew up, my dad was a Boston firefighter. We are very involved in the union. I also grew up union. So I understand the power and the need for union. So that was really hard. And I will say that what was so hard about it was, I still think some relationships are broken. And to follow that up with the pandemic and then sent us home, that was really hard. So something I've done to answer your question about what I've done to overcome it is, again, just working hard on those relationships, and reminding teachers that now that the strike is settled and we've gotten all that, again, why are we here? We're here for teachers. So now that that noise can kind of be blocked out, we can, again, focus on teaching and learning. But that was, I'll tell you, if you ever experienced something like it, it's terrible. It's really, it's hard. It's like seeing your family outside in the, you know, like it was just, and I had to stay inside the school and I stood in there by myself. It was very, it's a strange feeling.
You know, we didn't have an actual strike, but we had a couple with sick outs and then like a few walkouts, if you will. And you're right. I do remember that because, you know, at the end of the day, I'm a teacher at heart. Do you know what I'm saying? And so I understood everything that the teachers were needing and wanting and stood behind them getting better pay and all the things, you know. And then, but then to your point, there's the other side of, there's the kids not learning, but it's almost like for the kids to get more, the teachers deserve more. Yeah, right?
That's it.
And so it was really interesting at our at Kenwood, we actually, because there was almost, because our union is a very, very, very strong union. You know, and what I'll say is I'm in the same boat as you. Like my mom retired from General Electric. And so I grew up, you know, I knew, right? You know, so so I was very familiar with what that looked like, but it was, I still have the video because it's very heartwarming in that the sense that there were all kinds of schools that were arranging kind of a walk out, but not walk out and leave, just almost a walk out in demonstration of here's what could happen, right? Mm-hmm. But Ed, I have to tell you that the morning that it was organized, because of course the media was there, not just at our school, but across the district, right? Mm-hmm. We had parents and we had students. And they were around our school cheering for our teachers. Yeah, so it was it was the good stuff to where, you know, there's so many things I feel like that can divide, you know, schools and families, or can divide teachers and principals. There are so many things that are constantly trying to make that division, that this was, it's sad to say that what united us was a walkout, mm-hmm. but at the same time, it was, we were all, the reason why I think we were so united was because we were all kind of fighting for the same thing, which is better conditions so that students can have better teach, you know, the whole thing. And to have that was remarkable. Now, what I will say is that that was not the same feeling across every school in the district. Okay. And that goes back, to your point about relationships are so important, because it would be easy for parents to just kind of take the adage of, you know, get your lazy ass to work and teach my kid, right? Like it would be real easy for parents to take that approach. But because our school is a lot like yours in the sense that those family community partnerships are key to our success, that when things get tough, you know, we really kind of come together. And that was a sad situation to have to do that with. But it there is almost that feeling of, okay, if we can do this, we can do anything. And then to your point,
what can we not do exactly?
And then COVID hits, and then we have to try something else, right? But you know, it's all those things. So, how long was the strike, Ed?
Luckily, it was just one day. It was on a Friday, and then it went into the weekend, and then it was like, I forget if it was Saturday night or Sunday night. I mean, they negotiated till about 3 or 4 in the morning, and got it done. And it was, you know, the hard part is, though, it's not just the day of the strike. Because, the day of the strike is that, you know, we had parents to come out and support the teachers, you know, and even I a little bit, you know, they needed a trash bag. I was like, of course, I'll come out and bring you a trash bag, you know. And so that feeling, but it's really those moments leading up to it. It's it's, you know, and it can divide staffs too, because sometimes there were some teachers who were like, why are we going on strike? No, this, you know, this is creating noise and I don't support it. So then, you know, staff was disagreeing with each other. So although the strike was only one day, I will say the effects of the process leading up to the strike and after, I still think they're still lingering a little bit. We're growing and we're trying to fix that. But it's going to take a little bit more time, I think.
Yeah, and those are definitely the things they don't teach you in principal prep. So look, add that to your presentation if it's not over there.
Volume 2.
Well, you know, Ed, you know, you talk so much about how much you have to give of, you know, give of yourself and give yourself to the job, that I think we could probably work around the clock. I tell everybody all the time, I could literally never leave my building. And there would still be work to do. But, you know, we've got to set those boundaries, which isn't always easy. And as I find, as I talk with leaders across the country, that probably is one of the things that is an area of growth for all of us.
Yes.
But when you think about, but we know the importance of it. So have you found some strategies that you think are, that you've found to be successful in setting boundaries that help protect your time so that you have time for yourself and your family, so that you can be the best for your school family?
Yeah, this is definitely, Jill, this is the hottest question that's on the list. 100%. It truly is. Yeah, I think, you know, during COVID, especially where, you know, those lines blurred, especially when we were working from home, the lines blurred. So I immediately set with my staff the rule of I was not going to answer text messages, phone calls, or emails after, I think I said it at like 4:30. Mm-hmm. So that was definitely one, setting those boundaries. Another thing I do is I don't email my staff on weekends. Because I don't want them to email me back. So I do that. I think, you know, setting, because we're leading by example. Mm-hmm. So I want them to know that it's important to take time. And the last thing is, and you just kind of said it in your lead up to the question, is I make myself leave. During COVID, I got a dog. So that made it easier. I have to get home for him. But before that, right, like I don't have kids. I'm not married. So you can stay till 6 or 7 o'clock at night, but there's still plenty of work to do. So setting a time to actually leave is definitely big, because the building's still going to be there, you know?
Oh, it's totally going to be there. You know, something that that our admin team did that I didn't do when I first became principal, because when I first became the principal, like every day was late day for me, right? Mm-hmm. But then over time, our admin team was so great that we all chose, like, okay, everybody choose a late day. Right.
So, oh, that's genius.
Yeah. So like for me, my late day is Monday, you know, and we try to make it accommodating to where, you know, every year we revisit, because, you know, like my daughters played lacrosse. So usually their games were like on Wednesdays and Thursdays. So I try to get it on a different day, but then that way, you know, and then kind of defining, so what does late day mean? You know, and for us, it's like, well, you're there until at least 5. Mm-hmm. And then if a situation occurs, you're there until the situation is handled. Mm-hmm. And so that has helped tremendously for us, because that is kind of showing that I, you know, and I'm so grateful to my admin team, because they're so amazing for that. But that's really allowing everyone else to know that, okay, on a typical day, 4:15, 4:30, when the last bus is gone, I'm out of there. Do you know, not that people have to leave, because there are days when it's not my late day, I'm still there. But on those days, I know that I can be in my office. And if a bus comes back with a kid, or, you know, if a parent comes up for whatever reason, I know that I'm not the one responsible for that. So that's really allowed us to protect our peace to a certain degree. And just kind of, you know, if you've got a doctor's appointment or whatever, that you're always scheduling things around that.
Yeah, Jill, I love that. Because that's the thing. I think what you're doing too is, and we have done this as a society, I think, and I know I see it a lot on social media, really, like, we need to stop, you know, glamorizing mm-hmm. burnout, like where it's like, oh, well, I was there. I was at work today for 12 hours and I didn't take a lunch and I couldn't even find time to eat anything. And it, for some, like, we think that makes us, you know, better or, you know, seem like the hardest working. But I mean, I think I'd actually find more value if I talked to someone who said, man, I got everything done that I had on my list. And then I made sure to get home and I got to the gym and I got to spend time with my family.
Yeah, same. No, I agree. I've noticed that trend on social media, and just kind of what you said is glorifying it. So it's like, oh, well, I see your 12 hours. I was there 13 and yes. and only had 2 sips of water, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, because if you think about it over time, that's kind of been what society has, you know, glamorized as mm-hmm. as what it takes to succeed. And that also, I think, sends a really bad message to your staff as well.
Yes.
That, you know, you have to do all of that to be amazing. No, to your point, I am ready to learn how to do it all in much less time. You know, I keep thinking, gosh, after doing this for so long, you think this job would be getting easier and I'd be working less hours, you know, but it's that whole reflection and growing thing. But to your point, I think that we've got to quit, you know, and when we hear our staff members, you know, talking about that, and then suddenly you have the one person's like, oh, well, you know, I go home at 4:30 every day and, you know, and suddenly, what happens? People look at them like, oh, well, she's not very hardworking.
Oh.
That sort of a thing, you know, and it's like that sort of guilty feeling. So I think that we have to normalize self-care or not glamorize the person who's working around the clock.
Yeah, I think of, especially in our profession, let's face it, especially at the elementary level, mm-hmm. It's pretty female heavy. And I think about these poor new mothers who feel like they still need to do it all, or that they're somehow going to be looked at as not as good a teacher because they have to leave early. I'm mm-hmm. sorry, to go spend time with your baby?
Like, right. Yes.
No way. Yes. Let's lift that up. Let's lift that up. Like being an awesome teacher and prioritizing getting home to your family. It's something. I'll tell you what, Jill, I want you to check up on me in like a month or two. I mean, you and I are going to be talking a lot anyway, but yeah. I'm going to set that late night and I want you to hold me accountable for that.
Okay. Yeah, for sure. Like I say, it's really helped because the other thing that I think when I do with that, Ed, is I start to then look at my to-do list and think like, okay, what things do I need some just focused concentration time on? All right, well, then that's going to be my Monday night work. You know, and oftentimes for me, usually I make it, you know, I give myself permission to usually stay to like 6 o'clock on those nights without guilt because I know that I'm not staying that late every night. Instead of staying, you know, an extra 20 minutes here, an extra 20 minutes there, I usually will have one fairly long day, but then that feels like, okay, I'm giving myself permission to work late this day so that I don't have to, you know, nickel and dime it for the rest of the week or have to work as much on the weekends and things like that. Because you're right. You know, it's easy to give in and give all of yourself and then have nothing left. And that's what I was finding over and over and over and over. And no matter how great and polished things you put out for your teachers are, if you're not polished and put together because you're worn out, nothing else that you're putting out matters, right?
Preach it, Jill. I love that.
Well, Ed, you are clearly very connected. I know that one of the sessions that you did at NAESP was the boom session,
yes.
To where you all, you know, lots of great educators from across the country just shared, like, here's just a, you know, a quick, fast and furious bunch of great ideas. And so when you think about, you know, and I know that you understand the importance of a strong professional learning network and staying connected. Who are two or three people that you feel like, okay, if these people don't know, follow, have read their book, subscribe to their whatever, they've got to know these people?
Yes. So this is the second hottest question. But the first one I'm going to say is, and he has definitely become more of a professional, you know, leader that I follow is, and everyone write this down, right? You need this name. His name is Andy Jacks. Have you ever heard him speak at NAESP, Jill?
Oh my gosh. Let me tell you, I go to Andy sessions at every time I attend. Yes.
I've said this to him before too. He makes me at the end of a session want to run through a wall and teach kids. Like I'm like the Kool-Aid man. Like I just want to go. So Andy Jacks, connect with him on social media, but all on Twitter, especially, but also, he put out a book, Discipline Win. He has an amazing podcast as well.
Mm-hmm.
He's definitely one, and he's just a good guy. And just like you, Jill, like you reach out to him. I went to a session by him about, he was the one that I followed, no suspensions. And he said, I don't suspend kids. And I literally emailed him like a week after the conference, and he sent me his whole presentation that I could show to my staff. So he's definitely one. And then Dr. Ryan Daniel, she's excellent too. She's pretty active in NESP. She was in the boom session as well. It was my first time meeting her. And she's just awesome on Twitter. She's just, she's fearless. She believes in equity in schools, and she believes in making sure that she puts the best people in front of her students. So definitely she's a good follow, Dr. Ryan Daniel. And then there's so many other people. The other one that I wanted to make sure I mentioned as a resource, the book is called Teaching with Poverty in Mind. It's by Eric Jensen.
Mm-hmm.
I highly recommend that because it kind of gives the research behind what Eric, you know, what Jensen says, and then puts it into practice as well. It's a great book. And can I give four? I know it's
Look, you can get five if you want.
Oh my goodness! Again, fine. 3 hours it is. The other one, it's another podcast because you know, Jill, sometimes it's, you don't have time when you get home, but that ride to school, right?
Preaching to the choir there. Yes.
Yes. That's your time. So it's called Nice White Parents. It's a podcast. I believe it's by the New York Times. Highly recommend it because I will tell you, it's really the story about, it's kind of a dual story there, but one of it is about these nice white parents that came into this very diverse school and thought that they were doing good because they were, you know, pouring resources into it. And then, but they were kind of making it into the school that they wanted it to be. Mm. And the minority folks that were there were kind of like, well, wait, we thought the school was actually pretty good before you got here. We liked it here. So it just kind of talks about how even though the best intentioned people can make mistakes and make things not so great. So it's just, it was eye-opening for sure.
Ooh, I'm definitely checking that out.
Nice white parents. I can't recommend it enough. It was really, really, and there's going to be times, Jill, I'm just going to warn you, where you might go, ooh, I think I've done something like that, but that's okay. You learn and grow.
Hey, you know, I tell you, I think that's awesome. And I really think it's great to where you get to a point with your school to where you're all, or at least the majority of you, are vulnerable enough to start to look inward. And, you know, and that's what we, you know, one of the sessions that I presented on in ASP was also around family engagement. And, you know, that agency part with families and the advocacy part, I say all the time, when people are always like, we don't have any volunteers. I wish we, okay, if 100 people showed up tomorrow, would you have something for them to do? And two, do you really want the families in the school? Because you have to be ready for that governance. You can't start asking people what they think and then do nothing with it, because yes, then that will. So I think, you know, when schools really, and I don't mean just by let's send out a survey, just say we sent it, but I mean, really get to a point to where you're able to look inward and hear what people have to say, even when it doesn't feel good, and then be able to act upon it. That's powerful. And so that's exciting stuff. But no, heck, that's been my whole career, Ed. What are you talking about? Where I hear something and I'm like, yep, that was me at one point, you know, but it's okay. No, that's the most powerful thing I think you've said today. Well, you've said so many, but I just love it, is that that's okay. And so don't be afraid to say, oh, that was me at one time. Because I think that if you're not able to admit that, then you might be stifling your growth to move forward, right? It's almost like that, you know, until you admit there's a problem, you can't move past it. And so, and that doesn't make you a bad person. That's the thing I want people to, you know, when you think about all the training, I think about all the training that we've done with like equity and like implicit bias and microaggressions and things like that. And racism, I could go on and on, but it's like, yes, you have to admit it. You know, admitting it doesn't make you a horrible person. It just makes you human, who is now starting to be more self-aware, and that's how you grow.
Yeah, and imagine what that does for your staff when they see you admit it. Mm. You say it, like, what that gives them such permission to do it as well.
Yes. Oh, trust me. I'm the biggest question asker in the room. I'm the first one to say, like, yep, that was me. But again, to your point, one, because it really was me, but two, when it's like you're giving your staff permission to be vulnerable. And that's, you know, Brené Brown talks about all the time. Yeah. And so that's a skill I think that I wish that they would have taught more in leadership prep, was a little bit more about vulnerability doesn't make you a weak leader.
Yes.
All right, Ed, so you're a listener, so you know what my last question is going to be for you.
I'm glad I was a listener. That's when I hear people say, you didn't put that question on there. I'm like, oh, well, yep.
I love this question so much. One, because it requires such introspection, but two, I think I've told, you've heard me say this. This is actually the last question we ask in every one of our interviews, because people can sometimes really nail an interview. Then we get to this one and they'll literally say, we've not hired people because of one word and explanation they've given us. We're like, oh. Yeah. So all right, but what are three words that other people who know you would use to describe you?
I think one would be fair. And I think by that it means that I don't treat everyone equally, but I do hold people to the same expectations. Mm-hmm. And it's just that I scaffold those expectations accordingly with what I believe people can do and help them to grow. So I think people would say that I'm fair. I think people would say that I'm passionate. When I believe in something, I will go to lengths to make sure it happens. So I'd say I'm fair. I'd say I'm passionate. And I think they would say I'm optimistic. I think that I was going between a couple. I think I'm optimistic, and I want to make sure that I delineate the difference between, you know, because we know there's positivity and toxic positivity. Mm-hmm. I am positive a lot of times, but I will say I'm always optimistic. I always do believe the best is possible, and maybe not right in that moment, but I think people would, to a fault, and it's sometimes annoyingly so, but people would say that I'm optimistic. I always do believe the best can happen.
You know what, Ed, I'm so glad that you clarified, because I think sometimes people do kind of loop those two words together. positive and optimistic. And while, you know, I don't know what the thesaurus says, they could be synonyms for one another. I think what we've learned is that the word positive has gotten a really bad rap because of that toxic positivity. And so your point to say that, okay, optimistic doesn't mean that I'm disillusioned to think that we are in a challenge right now. Optimistic in the sense that I believe things can get better. Yes. And that's the difference. Instead of saying, oh, you know, the ship is sinking right now. Oh, let's just all smile and, you know, sing. That would be, you know, but optimistic in the sense of, I feel that if we work together, we can come up with a solution to plug the hole that's sinking the boat, you know, or something like that. So right. I think that's a real big need. If people haven't clarified that in their mind, that to distinguish the two, that's important. Because I've read a lot of blogs that really kind of talk about how a good culture can take a real nosedive when toxic positivity kind of starts to bleed in there. And I do think that there are some leaders that confuse the two.
You have to. And, you know, I think about day one of, you know, when we came back for the 2020-2021 school year, I went to a first grade teacher, Jess, and she wouldn't mind me telling the story. And I went in and I said, well, you know what? At least you got through the day. And she said, Ed, I'm not ready to hear that right now. And I was like, girl, you're right. I'm sorry. I'm out of here. But in my head, I was optimistic that it wasn't always going to be this way, that this too would pass. But right at that point, she couldn't have my positivity because it was toxic. She was exhausted.
Yeah. Well, and you know what? Kudos to you for creating a culture that your people feel comfortable saying that to you. Do you know right. what I'm saying?
Yeah, thank
well,
you.
You know, that you've created that culture, but two, that you're receptive enough of a leader to hear that and say like, oh, thanks for checking me on that. I appreciate Yay! That. So that's just another sign of your great leadership. Well, Ed, I, you know, I'm a little bit obsessed with you, so I'm so excited. I can't wait. I tell everybody I'm coming up to Massachusetts.
Get on up here. You got a place to stay. I've got a second bedroom.
I definitely want to visit because, you know, we connected socially and I'm dying to see, you know, your new school and all the great things. So we are certainly going to stay connected. But if other people want to reach out to you, to follow up on something that you said or dig a little bit deeper with.
Yeah. And you know, and I truly hope people do because I do, I reach out to people. And Jill, I'm definitely going to be reaching out to you because I've got some questions about things that you said at the conference. So I hope people do the same with me. But so on Twitter, I'm @Ed_Paris, and Paris is spelled just like the city. And so that's my Twitter handle. And then, or you can email me at edwardfasinfrancisparis@gmail.com. And I really do hope people connect with me or connecting with others, because it can feel like a very lonely job, but being able to, I mean, I have a colleague now, and I'm going to try to say it correctly, Louisville, Kentucky, that I can reach out to now. That's an amazing, amazing thing.
I mean, it really is, because, and that's one of the things that we've talked about, is that this can be such a lonely job. Mm. And so one, it's great to have, you know, comrades that are close to you within driving distance, but it's also great to connect, you know, across the nation. And that is one of the great things about conferences like NAESP, is that you're able to connect with people to, you know, share and get new ideas, but also to help, you know, kind of sit in some of the struggles or challenges that you're having that are similar, even though you're not in the same district, even though you're not in the same state, and kind of help work through those, you know. And then you think about building those lifelong friendships, which I think, Ed, you and I are going to be lifelong friends from this
for
point
sure.
out.
Yes. Absolutely.
All right, Ed, well, thanks for being on the show today.
Oh, Jill, thank you so much for having me. This was honestly the best use of a Monday night I absolutely could have had. This was amazing.
All right, well, you have a great start to your school year.
Oh, thank you so much, Jill. Good luck with the rest of yours too.
All right, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode, Inclusionary Leadership, How to Lead as Your Most Authentic Self, please share it with your friends by using the social media buttons you see at the bottom of the post. Now, friends, if this is your first episode or you've not listened to any of the other amazing interviews from this season or any of the other seasons, I encourage you to check them out. And a great way to do that is by subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. In fact, do it right now. And friends, if we aren't connected on Twitter and LinkedIn, let's change that status. And finally, Please take a moment to leave an honest review and rating on Apple Podcast. They really do help me out when it comes to the ranking of the show, and I make it a point to read every single one of the reviews that I get. All right, leaders, have a great week, and don't forget to ask yourself, am I the leader I deserve, and what am I doing about it?